Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. We're about to have another conversation with Tore. He's come up with a new book, I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an Icon. And Tore, of course, is co-host of MSNBC's The Cycle. He is a columnist for Time.com and the author of a number of books. Last time he spoke, it was his book that caused a lot of stir, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, which was a bestseller, and lives in Brooklyn. I have no idea where he is right now, but he's with us.
I'm at NBC right now. I've got to start getting prepared for the show as soon as we finish.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Our confab once again. Yeah, you know, I mean, this, you know, I mean, Prince, man, you know, I mean, the guy's so critical to, you know, to my generation, to our self-conception, you know, to, you know, just the sort of that sort of soundtrack of our youth. And I wanted to go really deep into who he is, you know, what he's all about.
Well, let's just jump right into this. I mean, I'm because I had two kids who grew up. You're Gen Xers who...
How old are your kids now?
Those two are 45 and 43.
Okay, so yeah, they're definitely Gen Xers, but they're really early.
Yeah, but Prince was huge in my house.
Oh, no, I'm sure. I mean, as early Gen Xers, they're definitely old enough to grasp, you know, the complexity of the music. You know, I was I'm a little younger than them, and I was getting it, but like when Purple Rain came out, right. I was still young enough that my parents would be like, no, you can't go see that movie, and, you know, right. The things he's talking about with Darling Nikki, like I had not experienced anything like that, so it was still new to me, and like a lot of people say, like, well, when I think of Gen X, I think of Nirvana and Tupac, and I mean, that's totally right. You know, but that's what the later Gen Xers were into. The early Gen Xers were completely blown away by Prince.
And, you know, when you talk about that, people don't think of Gen X often. They always look at Gen X, and you kind of take this on really strongly in your book. They don't think of Gen X as a black thing.
Yeah.
They think of it as just a white thing. And so, let's hit that one first. I mean,
I understand that feeling, because when Gen X is discussed in media, when it's portrayed in film, you know, like John Hughes's movies, it's a very white sort of world that is discussed. But the fact of the matter is that we lived in this generation. We were not living in some sort of separate country. We were deeply affected by the things that have a great effect on the rest of the country in terms of divorce, latchkey children, AIDS, crack, you
right.
know, the sort of, you know, America losing its place as, you know, central, you know, in the global story. You know, but I mean, like, AIDS, crack, and divorce as three of the major things
right.
that affected Generation X. Can anybody really say that Black America didn't have those things affecting it? I mean, of course not. Of course, those
it's
things
insane,
affected
right.
us as much, if not more. You know, so you know, just to, so if you're saying, you know, there's a media critique, and how come we're not seen in these John Hughes films, these sort of things? You know, then fine, I understand that. But, you know, divorce, AIDS, crack, you know, MTV, widespread economic troubles in America, you know, the birth of hip-hop, you know, this is what Generation X is marked by, is shaped by, and those things are absolutely part of our lives.
And the way you describe the world around Prince, that he, even though he was born in 1958,
right.
he's growing up in this kind of really broken home in Minneapolis. He's becoming a loner in high school. They're talking to all the folks that did in his early life, which is really interesting. I mean, because that sense of who he was, where he came from, he became somehow. And you talk about this notion of icon. He somehow became this icon, this multiracial, multisexual icon that represented all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the 80s was about, you know, political correctness and multiculturalism and this sort of breaking away from, demography as destiny. You know, hopefully people can become who they want to become, you know, thanks to affirmative action and other things, you know, and not have, you know, demographics hold them back if they're black or brown or women, right? You know, the gay rights struggle starts to really kick in a little bit later. And certain cultural figures were dealing with that and pushing some of those boundaries, and I think Prince, as much as anybody, is pushing it really hard, you know, really fast, you know, and just sort of demanding all the freedom possible, you know, of one body, you know, and like, I'm going to borrow a little bit from black and white, I'm going to borrow a little bit from male and female, you know, am I, you know, am I, do I believe in God, or am I secular, or am I spiritual, you know, I mean, it's sort of all going on there. He's all sort of pushing all these buttons, and that was a very 80s sort of gesture, you know, that a lot of these things were being worked out in public by sort of the collective culture.
And so taking Prince as he represents that, I mean, Prince was, the way you describe him, as a musical genius, as someone who in some way saw himself as kind of the incarnation of Mozart, and maybe even the incarnation of Jesus. I mean, there's a complexity about him that came through his work, and I think that many people don't see how his words, not just literally his music, but how his words, how his theatrical persona really were very deep and profound in what they offered and how it spoke to people. I don't think most people really wrestle with that when it comes to Prince.
No, I agree. I think that the sexuality was so in your face and so delicious and so seductive that for a lot of people you sort of land there, and that's what you think of Prince as, like this hypersexual artist. And you got to go deeper and allow yourself to redefine what you think of him to get to, you know, oh, like this is also this hyper spiritual being who's talking about God and Jesus and the devil in extraordinarily traditional ways. Rock and roll is generally this sort of sympathy for the devil thing and, you know, iconoclasm. And, you know, he's like, live a good life, you know, listen to God, follow Jesus, you know, reject the devil. Very, you know, traditional sorts of messages. I mean, even, you know, Purple Rain, the album, I think a lot of people, you know, would think of Darling Nikki, you know, and let that sort of be the thing that sort of defines how they think of Prince, you know, or When Doves Cry. You know, but then you get, you know, when you listen to the album, you know, front to back, it starts with a sermon, right? He starts Let's Go Crazy with the sermon about Doctor, Everything Will Be All Right, and, you know, again, a very traditional sermon where he's talking about, you know, this life is harder because this life you're on your own as opposed to the next life when you'll have God, you know, to help you. And then at the end of the album, you get Purple Rain right after I Would Die for You, maybe memory serves.
Right, right, right.
And Purple Rain is baptism. I mean, I Would Die for You is definitely speaking in the voice of Jesus. And then Purple Rain is about baptism, you know, and the third verse is in redemption. You know, the third verse is about I will be the one baptizing you and redeeming you. You know, I mean, is that not a Christ-like gesture or a religious gesture, you know, and just the whole structure, beginning with a sermon, you know, and Let's Go Crazy kind of, you know, sort of approximates a service, an ecstatic Baptist church service in itself, and then concluding with this, you know, baptism. I mean, these messages are all over the place in his music. You just had to really sort of hone in past the sex.
I never meant to call you when you sorrow. I never meant to call you when you pain.
I'm here talking with Touré about his new book, I Would Die For You, Why Prince Became an Icon. And before we went to break, we spoke about the meeting of sexuality and spirituality in Prince's music.
So let's talk about how what you think the influences were that created this kind of duality in Prince's life and music, and what he spoke to generation was also wrestling with a similar duality. I mean, you spent a lot of time talking to Questlove, obviously.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, a lot of things go into that question. I mean, part of it, you know, is what Malcolm Gladwell talks about in terms of cultural timing, when you are born, and the impact that that specific period that you're growing up in has on you. And, you know, when you talk about Prince growing up and listening to music as a young man, right in that period when gospel music leaves the church and becomes everyday music and is played on the radio every day and is charting very high. And so he's not just exposed to gospel or religious music on Sunday, but all the time in popular radio. you know, that definitely shapes this being who will then grow up to give us, you know, sexual music, profane music, and spiritual music, Saturday night and Sunday morning, within one song, within one album, within one being. But that is a traditional black music trope of, you know, the profane and the spiritual combining in a Ray Charles and a Marvin Gaye and an Al Green and an R. Kelly. You know, we could go on and on. You know, that's a very classic thing that you see in lots of black music. And, you know, I actually had a really hard time trying to nail down why that is. And I talked to a lot of smart people, and they give a lot of different answers, but I can't really even nail down, like, one, you know, 100% this is it answer of, like, you know, this is why these two things are so wrapped up historically, you know, in black music. I don't know. So, you know, that's a classic sort of wrestling that you see.
And so so here again for me, one of the things I pulled out of this when I was reading the book, and I was listening, reading some of the book last night, and had to pull out my Princeton hat and my headphones as I was reading your book just to get the feel, is just that. I mean, the fact that in many ways that how America is defined by blackness, by its blackness, I mean the entire society, that Prince, in that both the duality of spirituality and sexuality, religion and sexuality that he pushed, and the thing, the duality you just talked about in terms of the gospel versus the kind of what was born out of the hardcore blues and the battle that took place, I mean, he really personified that. And maybe that's one of the reasons that he was able to cross all those boundaries in a different way than Michael Jackson did. In that, because people started wrestling with, who is he? Is he gay? Is he straight? Is he religious? Is he not? Is he black? Is he white? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, he brought a complexity to it. I mean, Michael Jackson kind of faded into white, but in some ways, but
I mean, you're absolutely right that there is an entirely different approach to these issues. And in a way, at their end goal is the same, sort of like, you know, you could call it, you know, Kingian. You know, I think Dr. King would like both of their end goals. You know, we're saying, you know, let's move beyond, you know, racism, racialism, prejudice, you know. But where Michael Jackson is a utopianist who's like, you know, I don't see color. It doesn't matter if you're black or white, you know, which becomes a very sort of facile statement about it. You know, whereas Prince, I think, goes through a more complex thought process to say, why does this matter? And instead of saying, I am neither, which I find rather facile, you know, and simplistic and sort of childish and naive, Prince is saying, I am both and everything, and, you know, why don't you just accept me there? Why are you stuck on labels? And that conversation comes up in a couple of his songs where he's like, why are you stuck on labels? You know, which is not to reject the the concept of race, it embraces the concept of race and says, why are you stuck on that? Yes, I am black and white, or maybe both. What does it matter? Maybe I'm straight, maybe I'm gay. What does it matter? And I find that to be a fairly profound way of looking at it.
So how did the Prince, as you write about, you talked to a lot of folks you went to high school with, people he knew growing up, even talked to him a bit, even though he wouldn't let you tape record, right? He wouldn't let you record.
That's right. That's right.
That was a little bizarre, but the way you describe it.
I mean, you know, that's sort of, he likes to mess with reporters, I think, ultimately, is what's really going on.
But when his young life, where his parents were divorced, clearly came out of a black world in Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
Interracial high school.
Sure.
And this broken home, thrown out by his father. They divorced when he was young. And we describe him as a loner. So talk about how you kind of put those things together and describe how that the young Prince, which was his real name,
mm-hmm.
How that molded what happened to the Prince that became this icon.
It's very interesting. His parents divorce when he's very young. He lived with his mother for a time, left her home. Then he lives with his father for a time. He either left or got kicked out of his father's home. He said he lived in many homes in Minneapolis and then lands at Beverly Anderson's home, the mother of Andre Simone, for the super fans will remember Andre Simone. And so he's living with her from age 13. But she is a divorcee, mother of six, who was pursuing an advanced degree. So I don't know how much time she had to focus on him as his own mother might have had, as the most of us have the experience of a mother, especially, who's really focused on you and making sure you're developing properly. I'm not certain how much of that he got. And that allowed him to develop as he wished, into the sort of fantasy that many of us would have. I want to be a rock god and, just play music all the time and perform all the time. And, most of us would have parents would say, well, that's a really nice dream, but, you also got to know, how to talk to people, and you got to know how to do other things. You got to be more well-rounded than that. But if you're left to your own devices, then you would just sit there and play music all the time and learn how to write and learn how to play and learn how to dress so that you could be a rock star. And, in many ways, he sort of lives the dream, in terms of I just want to eat cereal all the time. Like, well, there's no parent here to tell you you can't do that. So I'm just going to eat cereal all the time. And look what he became. He ate, a million boxes of, whatever, Frosted Flakes. And we're all like, wow, that's cool. I wish I could have done that. My mom made me eat a brown breakfast, And, of course, that would literally make you become fat. But this does not, although he develops into this person who is this extraordinary rock god, became the rock star he wanted to be, knows how to play lots of instruments, write, produce, all these sort of things. But the basic interpersonal skills of a person who can just interact with other people and have basic friendships. The people who are around him tell me that that does not exist. And that's kind of tragic that he can't have just the normal sorts of relationships that that most people are used to.
here with cultural commentator and writer Torrey, speaking about his new book, I Would Die For You, How Prince Became an Icon.
Something about, I just gleaned this from all the things, the different ways to describe Prince. The loner in high school, people saying they wouldn't even expect him to be this persona on stage because of who he was
right. In
high school. The women you've interviewed who are his wives, ex-wives and girlfriends who just talk about him not being really, did not know how to deal with women. Was some people thought he was anti-woman, very closed off. But at the same time, his response to all that as a young guy was to become more intense and like a workaholic, as you describe him, kind of grabbing everything, whether it's his music, his writing, and he didn't stop. He was like a driven. His response to being saddened by his life or whatever that was just to be driven and focused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the interesting thing about him and how that and his own spirituality made him explode onto the scene in a very strange way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you describe that the time when he first went on stage,
mm-hmm.
how people threw stuff at him.
Well, that was not his first time going on stage, right? But yeah,
But one of his problems with the Stones.
Yeah, he opens up for the Rolling Stones in California. I believe it was 82, memory serves. And, it's a real hardcore rock and roll audience, you know. I think the Jake Isles Band was also on there, on the bill. It's a real rock and roll crowd, and they were not really trying to hear, this guy in panties singing about, some bullshit. I mean, George Thorogood and the Destroyers were also on the bill, right? You know, we're at the L.A. Coliseum. The Rolling Stones are going to be here for 2-3 days blowing it out. And, Prince comes out there and does, some of his Dirty Mind stuff. And, why you want to treat me so bad? And he's wearing, panties and leg warmers and tights and heels and... They're like, what? And I'm sure part of it is because he's black and part of it because he's sort of challenging the norms of masculinity, especially what you would see on a rock and roll stage. And, I think those things are very threatening to people. And when you see the very violent reaction, people throwing things, at the crowd, at the stage, you see that. And that happens on Friday night. And then again on Sunday, Prince and them come back and perform, and again people are throwing things, chicken bones, Jack Daniels bottles, and what have you. And it just sort of represents, how threatening and challenging it is to say, I reject what you're doing.
So to just conclude, because I know you got a role, about where you think he is now and what he says to us now, because he's getting older. I mean, he's in his 50s. He's in some ways came back on the scene. You talk about him having to, gone into the internet age and really jumped into that and changed his name to the name that nobody could pronounce.
Yeah,
but then his kind of still deep Christianity, but his deep sexuality is still out there when he performs. Tell us where you think he is now and what he says to us.
Where he is now?
Yeah.
He's definitely getting a little bit more religious sonically as he gets older. I'm not sure how many of the more sort of just overtly bold, wild sexual statements that we're going to have from him. It's mostly a nostalgia artist at this point. The vast majority of what we want to hear from him, he already did. And, super fans are sticking around to hear what's next. But it's very, very difficult at, say 50 years old or something, to make really relevant popular music, it's almost never happens. He's still here and around, but
So finally, Torre, do you think he was, as you kind of describe him, as this trickster?
Yeah.
Who used his music to come to our door and had the Bible hidden in his guitar, as the way you put it, in parts of the book. I mean, do you think he's the trickster that kind of wormed his way into our life and left us with something indelible we can't walk away from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, he was totally messing with us on purpose, you know, being like, am I black or white? Am I straight or gay? You know, I mean, he totally lied about being mixed so that he could pass for mixed to access some of the benefits of white skin privilege, you know, which I don't blame him for. It was an intelligent move that opened him up to, you know, to the wider, broader culture rather than having to be sort of boxed in and stereotyped as, you know, well, you're a black artist. You may be great, but that's fine. That's all you are. And he's like, no, I want more than that. I want the world. And, you know, so, okay, how do I get that? Well, you know, some of it's marketing, some of it's what I do with my music, and some of it's, you know, I'm going to tell you that I'm mixed when you're not mixed. You know, his mother's name is Maddie Shaw. She grew up in Louisiana. You know, she's known for, as a child, she's known for playing basketball very well in the
right.
projects. You know, she grows up to become a jazz singer in Minneapolis in her early 20s, meets a much older black band leader who already had a family and marries him in the 50s at a time when, in the early 50s at a time when there were very, very few, you know, black, you know, mixed marriages. You know, plus on top of all that sort of ethnographic stuff, I have people who met her who say, yes, she was black. Like, you know, it's not a question. She was black. So, you know, but, you know, I mean, I think it was very interesting, you know, for him to sort of mess with us in that way and say, like, oh, yeah, I'm mixed. Oh, yeah, you know, like, am I black or white? You know, am I straight or gay? You know, it's sort of, it's just these marketing ways of drawing us in and thus, you know, getting us into the party that was this awesome music that he was making.
Torre. Really, always a pleasure to talk to you, brother. Always great to have you with us and put the stuff you put out there for us to kind of wrestle with. I think you're one of our important thinkers out there, and it's always great to read what you write. I would die for you when Prince became an icon. Torre, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.